Well, I think we'll start now. I'm very pleased to see all of you here. I really had no idea how many people would come out on a Sunday evening, but we have a very unique opportunity to learn about North Korea, a country that probably most of us have not been to and probably we don't have very good information about. So we're really fortunate. My name is Ed Martin. I'm the director of the Center for Interfaith Engagement here at EMU, but it's not in that role that this is happening tonight, and I'll tell you a little bit about why this is happening in a minute. But I'm very honored and pleased to introduce our guest, Kathy Zellweger from Switzerland, who has tremendous experience in North Korea. She was the director of the official Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation in North Korea for 5 years, from 2006 to 2011. And some of you probably saw the posters from North Korea that were on display in the library early last semester, I think September and October. She collected those while she was working there and made them available to us to display here. She also worked many years for Caritas, based in Hong Kong, and while there developed the program both in China as well as in North Korea. And I know from my years working with MCC that she was very much involved in coordinating efforts of a number of organizations to work in North Korea, including the Mennonite Central Committee. She's now at Stanford University as a Pantech visiting scholar in the Korea program, has been there, about a year now, I guess, and will be there through this coming, until next summer. And why is she here? How did this happen? It all happened because we have a mutual friend in Palo Alto, someone who I met 42 years ago when I was a student at Stanford University, and I had to get a loan, and I went into the financial aid office and into this guy's office, and he says, "You know, we don't give loans to Mennonites." And his name was Ken Kaufman, and he was a Mennonite. And recently, within the last year, Kathy met him on a bus, I guess, a shuttle bus, and they got to talking. And he is now retired from Stanford, but he heads up a foundation called the John Ernest Foundation. And that foundation does a lot of things, particularly networking. And I guess it was his idea that it would be good to display these posters from North Korea in universities. And somehow we had some contact again after all these years, and he asked, would I want to help get them to EMU? And so they were here early in the semester, and now they're on display at JMU and will be through the end of January. And so I've enjoyed the last day learning to know Kathy and hearing about North Korea, and it's, as we all who are somewhat informed about the world know, that much of what we know about North Korea is limited, and a lot of it's probably not accurate, and it's certainly we know very little about the people of North Korea, and so I am very anxious to hear more tonight. I think she will speak for about 40 minutes, and then show some slides, and then take questions and discussion. So, Kathy, we're so happy you're here, and look forward to hearing from you.
Well, thank you very much for the warm welcome. I'm also very happy to be here, and it's really a unique opportunity to talk about North Korea and the years I spent there and worked there. So thank you for having me. I have been engaged in humanitarian aid and development assistance to North Korea since 1995. And then for 5 years, from 2006 to 2011, I was a resident in Pyongyang, heading the office of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation. And that's an agency under the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And then just last October, I had an opportunity to go back after a year I had been away. And I was accompanying a Swiss delegation And it was very interesting to see the changes that had taken place within the year I'd been away. I have also been to South Korea many times. I see a lot of South Korean faces here. But my presentation today will focus on the other side of the divided peninsula. And during the years I worked for Caritas, we also received strong support for North Korea from the Mennonites, from the office in Canada and also the one in Akron. And I have actually been to Akron maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I can't remember. And I have very fond memories of that collaboration. I still see smiling children when they receive the school hygiene kits. Canned beef or canned meat was another very treasured commodity from the Mennonites, or the quilts, and so on. So happy memories, and thank you for that support. It did make a big difference to the people on the ground. So when you say North Korea, the average reaction around the world is to immediately think of nuclear weapons, of hunger, of misery, but also to easily forget that there are 24 million ordinary people who live there, who are struggling day by day to make ends meet and to simply live an ordinary life like you and I like to have. My talk this evening will focus on three main points. The DPRK, North Korea after the death of Kim Jong-il. Why is there a need for humanitarian aid and development cooperation? And is North Korea changing? And at the end, I will illustrate my talk with about 100 slides I took during the years I was there. To underline my points, I would like to give you a few key findings from the 2008 population census. The census was done with the assistance of the United Nations Population Fund and also the Swiss government. And we now feel we have reasonably good figures about North Korea. The total population in October 2008 was 24,052,000 something. It is a very homogeneous society with no significant minority groups. Only in the northern part of the country, there are a few hundred Japanese spouses of Koreans and a small Chinese community. But otherwise, a very, very small foreign community. Let me also just add, we were around 400 foreigners in the whole country, of which almost 300 belonged to the Russian and the Chinese embassies, and the rest were people working for the UN and NGOs and embassies. So a very, very small foreign community, and everybody knew everybody. Back to North Korea, the population structure, about 8.7% are 65 years or older, whilst in comparison in South Korea, the older population is 9.3%. The two oldest populations are in Italy and Japan, where over 20% of the people are over 65. So it's still a reasonably young population. Life expectancy at birth is for male 65.5 years, for females 70.2 years. On average, people in South Korea live 12 years longer. And I think this is a very telling figure about the situation in the north. 60% are urban. This is almost unchanged. And the average household size is 3.9 people, so about four. But 31% of all households consist of nuclear families, on average with three members. I have, for many, many years, never seen a family with more than two children. Almost everybody gets married, with very few divorces. And male boys are 28.4 years old when they marry, and girls 25.6 years. The literacy rate is also very interesting. Among those 10 years old or over, it is nearly 100%. I have never met a North Korean who cannot read and write and also do the basic maths. There are 11 years of free education and compulsory education for boys and girls. When we look at tertiary education, that changes. More male get the opportunity to get to a university than girls. And people with an academic background also tend to reside in urban areas. About 17.4 million are civilians above the age of 16, part of the workforce. They work, 70% work in state enterprises, on cooperative farms, or in government institutions. And of this, 36% are in agriculture, forestry, and fisheries, 24% in manufacturing, and 6% in public administration. And with that, I stop bombarding you with figures. The big four worries for an ordinary North Korean family are: do we have enough to eat? Is our home warm? Is everybody healthy? And are the children getting decent schooling? Basic needs that should be covered, but are now issues of survival. The contrast between Pyongyang, the capital, and the rest of the country is stark and is growing. The capital seems to benefit from most of the resources, and the gap is widening between the have and have-nots, and more people are falling through an already very weak social safety net. Now, North Korea after the death of Kim Jong-il. It was just a few weeks after I had left Pyongyang on December the 17th, 2011. It was like a bombshell that dropped, the announcement of Kim Jong-il's death. And via television, the world was stunned by the many days of an incredible outpouring of grief. I am sure you have seen it too. I was still in California at that time and couldn't believe my eyes. And immediately speculations started with anything from collapse to reform to more clashes with South Korea or even to unification. And now young Kim Jong-un is in power. Also, my assumption is that there is a collective leadership in place. And this means the central figure, the family, and then the party and the military. This was basically already demonstrated during the many months Kim Jong-il was ill in 2008, and I was on the ground at that time. And even if there are frictions within the North Korean elite, regime survival will be placed above factionalism. The leadership in Pyongyang hopes that the future will solidly remain under the banner of continuity and stability. 2012 was a very important year for North Korea. In April, the 100th birthday of Kim Il-sung, the state founder, was celebrated. And then we had leadership changes in China, presidential elections in South Korea, and of course also an election year in the US. It is not yet clear what will result from all these changes. But I do hope a pass between the former sunshine policy and the frosty year of the Lee Myung-bak administration can be found, because the situation we have now is really not healthy and also quite dangerous, I think. From my view is that the North Korean regime believes that for its survival, it needs to maintain its nuclear weapons program, with perhaps a certain willingness to freeze or cap some elements. With the nuclear deterrent, the regime feels more secure and therefore also more inclined to gradually move forward with China's assistance or pressure in a slow economic reform process. However, provocations from North Korea can never be quite ruled out, be it because of internal dynamics or regional or international issues. But China, a major player in North Korea, also wants stability and not a flow of refugees across the border or problems in China's northeast. Overall, so far, the succession in North Korea seems to be going well, and I will speak later on about my recent trip to North Korea and observations I made, and a little bit of reasons for certain optimism. But now to the need for humanitarian aid and development assistance. North Korea has been receiving humanitarian aid and some development assistance since 1995. That was the time when the North Korean government asked for the first time in its history, through the UN system, the international community for help. And thanks to humanitarian aid, many lives have been saved, and improvements are clearly noticeable in terms of food security, health services, water and sanitation provisions, and so on. However, the food situation still is fragile. It is not a famine, but chronic malnutrition with pockets of extreme poverty and hunger. The diet is very unbalanced, with a strong focus on cereals or carbohydrates, with hardly any proteins, fats, or micronutrients. There are still a lot of hungry people in North Korea. And what to me is shocking is chronic malnutrition means stunting. So we have a generation that is at least that much smaller than their South Korean brothers and sisters. There is still a ration system in place. People are supposed to get rations from the government through the public distribution system. And on average, the rations are right now about 400 grams of cereals per person per day. And that is a mixture of corn and rice. Of course, the people would much rather eat rice, but rice is a big luxury. Now, 400 grams of corn or rice is about 1,400 calories. That is close to what we consider a diet. And then take into account that we have an extreme climate with minus 20 degrees Celsius over many weeks during the winter season and very hot weather in summer, where we have another problem that then the drinking water is not safe. About 67% of North Koreans are public distribution system recipients. They are supposed to get the rations from the government. And these are mainly workers. They should receive the staple food, but also the system has never been abolished. It does not function properly anymore. And rations are no longer evenly allocated across the whole country or across the whole population. Right now, the United Nations World Food Programme aims to provide targeted food aid to some 3.5 million vulnerable people. And that means nutritional support for women and children, support to school children, and food assistance to other vulnerable groups such as the disabled or the elderly. Especially in the northeastern provinces, these provinces are much more mountainous with even less arable land. And also during the lean season, and the lean season is always in late spring into summer when they have eaten up their own stocks and nothing has grown or very little has grown in their own fields. The World Food Programme conducts a lot of monitoring visits to see that food aid is reaching the identified target groups. And for example, in May last year, they did over 350 visits in 65 counties in all 9 provinces. And more recently, the World Food Programme managed to convince the North Korean government to allow also some Korean-speaking food aid monitors in. So we now have among the team at WFP Korean speakers, some from China, some from Russia, some from Mongolia. And they can interact a little bit more readily with the Korean food aid recipients. However, resources for the World Food Programme are a very big problem. And very often the planned programme has to be curtailed because of lack of funding. And I can tell you, cutting off beneficiaries is a very, very tough job. And it's not an easy decision to make. Who will get food aid and who will not get food aid? The various natural disasters North Korea faces every year, droughts and floods, are of concern year by year because they affect the vulnerable people disproportionately. So, why is humanitarian aid still needed? Well, one reason is simple, people don't have enough to eat. But I also believe to cover basic needs is a prerequisite for progress and change in order that the people, the general population, can be freed from daily worries and can gradually have the energy and time to think about their own situation, to assess reasons why are they in this miserable world of North Korea. So I do believe by improving people's lives, we also make a contribution to opening up a closed society. Also, I'm very well aware that humanitarian aid is not the solution for addressing long-term systemic problems. And of course, no doubt the North Korean government could do more, should do more, but will it do so? And can we let the people suffer? Another worry which a lot of people have is always, will the food go to the military? Will it be sold in markets, be hoarded or otherwise not reach the people it should reach? These are questions aid agencies have been grappling for many years, and not just in North Korea. The issue of monitoring must be addressed, and it can be addressed. Much better now, since the World Food Programme has over 15 years of experience in implementing food aid programs in North Korea. Moreover, mistrust should not be the reason for withholding aid. To help North Korean children is an investment for the future, but above all, it is also a humanitarian act. I would now like to give you a little bit of an insight into the development cooperation programs which I managed during the years I lived in Pyongyang. We addressed food security issues with a sloping land management program, or another project was in biological pest control for maize and cabbage. And we also run a capacity development program where we organized a lot of workshops in the country, but also sent every year about 80 to 100 people abroad for training. Young diplomats would study for up to 3 months in Switzerland. Then we had a wide variety of short-term programs with sometimes collaboration with universities in Beijing, for example, in the legal field, in banking or in finance. We even managed to send twice two North Koreans to a peace mediation course to Switzerland. So many small programs which do not see immediately an impact, but when you work there for longer, you see people start thinking, start asking questions, minds are changing. We also managed to send people for long-term studies, one academic year usually, in agroforestry. And this was in Kunming in China, where they were taught in English. So when they came back, all of a sudden they were fluent in English and they could communicate with outsiders much, much better, and moreover, present the projects themselves. And that makes a huge difference then when we foreigners do so. We also, and this is for me one of the most fascinating involvements we had during the years I was there, we also managed the Pyongyang Business School. And I'm sure you wonder, business in a planned economy? We conducted 4 cycles, and each one with 12 monthly seminars of 3 to 4 days for 30 to 35 middle managers from North Korean companies. And we flew in lecturers from the Hong Kong Management Association. The curriculum was like a mini MBA. And the Hong Kong lecturers told me later on they could not think of more eager students. And even now, I occasionally meet participants and I get very positive feedback. In fact, once I was stopped in the middle of the streets in Pyongyang, a gentleman jumped out of the car and thanked me profoundly what I had done for his wife, and I had no idea who he was and what I had done for his wife. And then he gave me a name card and said, "My wife attended the business school. She now runs her own restaurant. Go and visit it." And I never would have thought this would be possible in such a closed environment. And I must say, there is now a much bigger interest among North Koreans to learn how the market economy functions. They have realized if they want to do business with the outside world, they need to know how we think and how we tick in order to create a win-win situation. And so I really felt this had an impact, despite the fact that you cannot say it's, you see results immediately. And unfortunately, when you have to raise money for programs in North Korea, you know, in, well, anywhere in the world, the donor always wants to see results immediately. And that is sometimes quite an issue, how to present results. But in capacity development, you work with individuals, you work with organizations and societies, basically to strengthen human and organizational capacities so that they can manage their affairs much better. And you are putting people at the center of development, and you are finding ways of how to influence people's mindsets and how they find their own solutions. So is North Korea changing? This is a question I'm asked very, very often. And especially after having lived in Pyongyang for 5 years, I now call the changes the five M's. Markets and money are playing now a much bigger role in the daily lives of North Koreans. Mobile phones, the third M, have become a common form of communication, and motor cars have increased. And in Pyongyang, there are clear signs of a small middle class developing. So, markets, money, mobiles, motor cars, and middle class. My five I'ms. A friend of mine, of course, he's a journalist, developed his set of five M's and said, well, misery, malnutrition, menace, mania, and missiles, and maybe Mickey Mouse. So you can imagine what interesting arguments we usually have about change in North Korea. And now a few observations from my recent visit. I was amazed how different Pyongyang looks after a year, because when I left, the government had said, we are building 100,000 apartments, new apartments in Pyongyang. And when I left, they had pulled down some old quarters. And what do I see now? Among foreigners, it's called Little Manhattan. New, tall, modern apartment buildings, a new theater complex, a conference hall, an upscale supermarket with mostly imported goods, all part of an urban development project which had to be finished last year, 2012, the all-important year, the centennial of the birth of the state founder Kim Il-sung, and basically the grandfather of the present leader Kim Jong-un. And also on Mansudae Hill are now two giant statues. You will see them later on. Before, it was only one with Kim Il-sung, and now we have two with Kim Jong-il also there. And these are visited by thousands of people day by day. And we had a funny experience when we were there in October. We were told we couldn't go there. So I thought, well, doesn't matter, we'll see enough monuments during the week. But we passed it because we had a meeting at the People's Congress, and I saw the two statues covered in white, and a friend of mine said they look like burkas. It looked really strange, and a week later, we were told now we could go and visit. The statue had been given some cosmetic surgery, and the two leaders are now smiling. So much for change, cosmetic change. Also, in the countryside, some new villages have been built or settlements, but Pyongyang is the big beneficiary. And it's about 12% of the population that lives in the capital, about 3 million people. And it is obvious that the gap between urban and rural is widening. So poverty becomes pretty quickly visible once you leave the capital for other parts of the country. I also noted an increase in vehicles of all kinds, from passenger cars to buses and trucks. And bicycles have become a very common form for transporting goods and people. However, many, many ordinary North Koreans cannot afford a bicycle, and they walk and walk for hours, and very often carrying heavy loads on their backs because they have visited relatives on the farms, have been begging for some food. When I was there, the rice harvest was going on, and people were working very hard in the fields with hardly any agricultural machinery. And even if they have some simple machines, they have no diesel or fuel to run the machines. And children and old people were gleaning the harvested fields, collecting individual rice grains or maize kernels, putting them into wicker baskets or plastic bags, all in preparation for harder times. You may have read the Western press reported about some reforms in the agricultural policy, but I could not confirm that during the time I was there. But some of my former colleagues said that they see a possibility of some adjustments or changes this year. So let's wait and see. Another thing I noted is an increased number of tourists, mostly from China, but also from Western countries. And again, I think it's a very good way of exposing North Koreans to other societies. I also learned that the rules and regulations in the markets have been relaxed, and that has made life easier for people in terms of selling, buying, and bartering. And this, of course, is very important nowadays because they all have to earn some extra cash to make ends meet. By now, North Korea has about 2 million mobile subscribers. And to have a mobile telephone is a dream of every North Korean. But for ordinary people, it's still too expensive to purchase the handset. With a mobile or a small camera, people do business. They take photos or they do calculations on the mobile. They phone each other, compare prices in the markets. So there is much more of a dynamic now in the society. And also small businesses have been established. There is a bicycle repair workshop or shoe repair workshops. Sewing jobs are done. And of course, selling and bartering in all street corners. I felt overall the mood was a bit more relaxed. Women would chat with each other on the way to the market or home after work. Teenagers, boys and girls, some even wearing protective helmets and elbow and knee patches, had fun rollerblading in Kim Il-sung Square or in front of the Courier Hotel at night, even with lights. And young women's fashion has become a bit more trendier, more colors. High-heeled shoes are very, very in. And some may wear a little bit of jewelry or earrings or a small pendant on a gold chain. We were also informed by the North Korean government that they have adjusted the education policy and that children now will be receiving 12 years of free education. And it's 1 year additional secondary school with a strong focus on technical and vocational education, information technology, and foreign languages. They have changed a couple of years ago. It used to be Russian, the first foreign language children would learn, and a few years ago they switched to English. And many youngsters are now also learning Chinese because that's the door to the future. Interesting was also the fact that the usual rhetoric was very much turned down during all the official meetings we had. And also when chatting with my former North Korean colleagues or when visiting tourist spots. The military first policy was no longer mentioned at all. And that for me was really, really striking because before it was usually the second sentence of every conversation we had with North Korean officials. You probably have heard about North Koreans fleeing the country, mostly, well, practically all through China, and it's a very, very difficult journey. Last year, the number dropped dramatically, and I only have the figure January to September, and only about 1,086 people reached South Korea. So I think the number last year was similar to the one in 2005. So why did the figure drop? Why did fewer people leave? Border controls on both sides have probably increased. But I also felt people were a little bit more optimistic in Pyongyang that they could really make ends meet. The desire of the people is not necessarily leaving their home country. It's more finding ways and means to have a better life. So let's hope there will be a fresh wind in North Korea. There's also more workers that can go to Russia and China, government-sponsored programs, and when they return, they can keep a certain amount of their salaries, and that has brought in more money into Pyongyang. China's influence in North Korea is strongly felt. Most investments are Chinese. Most imports are Chinese, including food. Because doing business with North Korea is extremely complex because we have UN sanctions and we have US sanctions. So basically, no international business is interested in investments. So where is the money coming from when I have the feeling that things are changing? It is trading with China, but also the mining business. Then we have, of course, smuggling, we have corruption, but we also have North Koreans who bring in money from abroad because they work there, or remittances from defectors in South Korea. They cannot be officially remitted, but there are some channels, and a large sum does reach the families back home. Why is the regime allowing such activities? Improving people's livelihoods has been included in several New Year's editorials, and that is some sort of a policy address the leadership gives every January the 1st. And young Kim Jong-un seems to keep that focus. So I do feel he has realized that he has to somehow open up the country if he wants to survive. Strong and prosperous nation means for North Korea, we are strong. We have nuclear weapons. We now can focus on the economy. So there is more emphasis placed on international economic engagement, especially with China, Russia, and Russia and some Southeast Asian countries. The message already Kim Jong-il gave after his various visits to China was basically always learn from China's economic success. Chinese will be getting more involved with investments, with buying and selling goods. Cooperate with them. And this is what is happening now. In closing, life is still hard for ordinary people. The food security is fragile, and more people need food aid. The United Nations published a report not long ago and said that 16 million of the 24 million North Koreans continue to suffer from chronic food shortages, malnutrition, and deep-rooted economic problems. However, to me, it seems like the people have realized that they can no longer depend on government handouts and that they have to fend for themselves. So for the future, I see challenges and opportunities. Based on my experience in working in and working with the DPRK, I believe that isolation as a way to force change does not work in North Korea. People-to-people contacts are extremely important. Transformation can be stimulated by supporting first the basic needs, including education, by providing information and access to information, and also through market activities, trade, commerce, and tourism. If we look at the population size, South Korea today has almost 50 million people. It is the 25th biggest country in the world in terms of population size. North Korea has 24 million and ranks number 48. A united Korea would have, therefore, 74 million people and become, right after Germany, the 17th biggest country. A strong and hopefully democratic power in East Asia. For 60 years, the Korean Peninsula has longed for a lasting settlement based on justice, peace, reconciliation, coexistence, and mutual respect. But the suffering, the division, and the threats continue. If we favor a peaceful solution, we need to build bridges and not walls. Therefore, the use of soft power, engagement, encouragement, people-to-people contacts, exchanges, communication, but also persistence and a lot of patience. This is, however, hard work with successes and disappointments. Ultimately, I think the people on both sides of the Korean Peninsula will have to make it work. But we, as the international community, can support the process and work together towards this goal. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Kathy. I think we've learned a lot about some place we know very little about. And we have some time for questions, but we would ask people to come up to the mic here so that the audience can hear the question. And we're also doing a podcast, so we want to have people speaking in here. Maybe I'll start with the first question. You said that people-to-people relations are very important, that North Korea should not be isolated. How easy is it to bring about people-to-people relations? Does the government promote this or accept it, or is it something that's difficult? And probably it depends on which countries are involved, too.
Well, nothing is easy in North Korea. But if we don't try, nothing happens. So I would say you have to try. You need patience. It is a slow process. And the most important thing is building up a certain level of trust first. Only when they trust you, then they will probably invite you to come with a delegation to visit and to perhaps discuss collaboration. I have also realized over the years that, you know, sometimes we need to make them certain offers, bring them ideas, because they simply don't know what is available and what would be suitable for them. So it's trying, but I had no idea, literally no idea about North Korea. I'd been to South Korea a few times, but not North Korea. And in 1995, there was also hardly any information available about North Korea. So all I could do is continue the dialogue with the contact I had, and that was a North Korean official stationed in Beijing. And I think here in the US it would be probably the mission at the UN as a starting point.
This probably isn't the most important question, but I wonder about the food supply. Why not enough food? You touched on gardening, farming a little bit. The history of it, before the Korean War, was there enough food? That's the question, I guess.
Okay. Historically, the Korean Peninsula, the south was the agrarian part, and the north was the industrialized part. And of course, that all changed with the division and the Korean War. And therefore, the north had to start intensive farming, but they only have about 18% of good arable land. So land is very scarce. That's one problem. Personally, I think they might be able to produce sufficient food if they had all the inputs, but many of the inputs they need to import from China or from the region. So personally, I think if they could reactivate the industries earn money and import food, it may be more cost effective than trying to grow their own food. The soil is also very acidy. We did a lot of liming on the cooperative farms we worked. We tried to bring in some new methods as I said, biological pest control for cabbage and maize, but it all takes a long time until people can do it themselves. So to build on agriculture, I'm not too optimistic. I really think there needs to be other change too.
There's no large private ownership of land.
No, it's all cooperative farming. And then there are about 3,000 cooperative farms in the whole country. And then on the farm is organized like a small village, basically. It has school, primary school, kindergarten, nurseries, clinic, shops. And now the farmers have a very small plot, which is their own plot, where they can grow whatever they like to grow. And it's quite noticeable that a lot does grow on those small private plots.
Can they sell that?
That they can do whatever they like. It's sold, it's bartered. It's, of course, many farming families support their relatives in the city. I also heard that in the city, on the balconies, as I said, they may grow chicken or rabbits or pigs, and they swap that with grain from the countryside. So there's all sorts of bartering and trading going on. Moreover, every 10 days there are so-called farmers markets all over the country where farmers can sell and barter. It's only small quantities, but still it is happening and it is growing. Personally, we have tried to convince the North Korean government to enlarge the private plot, to loosen up a bit, but not with much success, I must admit.
So I have three questions. I was fortunate enough to about 30 years ago to the DMZ and look over, and at that time it was what they referred to as the fake city, because nobody really lived there. Those new skyscrapers, is anybody really living there, or did they just build those for show? That's my first question. Second, when Kim Il-sung died, was that really people where they were whining on the streets and everywhere? Was that staged, or did they really feel that way? And how do they mobilize 50,000 people freely when I can't even get my kids to take out the trash?
Good question, thank you. Now, the buildings in Pyongyang, we were, of course, asking also that question. However, first of all, they pulled down old residential areas, and those people need to be housed again because they were, for some period, some of them were in tents, so they moved in, that we saw. And when I passed there, and also my colleagues who live there, they do see people coming and going, and it looks like, you know, city people living there, not necessarily the elite, just city people. I would be surprised if they could afford that kind of wastage in a city of Pyongyang. I think people would probably object to that, so I don't think they are just shells. The death of Kim Jong-il, it is for us very, very strange to see this kind of weeping for days on end. I think some of it was genuine. I must also admit Maybe this has happened to you too when you have been at the funeral and everybody around cries.
Oh, I have one big question right there. You may have televised the Korean Channel when the people were there, the weeping with, but you know, when actually the somebody died, generally said, actually, this is a tear. Yeah. But all the TV they show, I didn't see any people here.
Oh, no. Cry. No, no, they were.
They all, to me, the fake
no.
Cry.
You know, as I just, if you let me finish my sentence, please. If you have been to a funeral where everybody cries around you, what do? You cry too. I cried at funerals. The person was not close to me. I had to go in my official capacity, but when everybody cries, you start crying too. So that is also something that has happened. I've been to schools in North Korea. The children stood up, looked at the two pictures, sang a very emotional song, and they started crying. And then even in Italy, we have people who are hired to cry at funerals. I mean, this is also customs and traditions. So I may disagree with you on that, but that's what I experienced. So it's very difficult to judge, and we are not there to judge. Mobilization of people, of course, it's a system of control, and your food depends if you go and do that work or not. And if you need food, you do go and do that work. At one time, even NGOs and UN agencies would do programs which we call food for work programs. So people were mobilized to fix a bridge that was damaged during the floods, and then they would get a certain amount of food after they had done the work. So, of course, in such regimes, you can mobilize people pretty easily. But it's amazing to see how they then get that work done and how it's organized top down.
Since you were part of the minority group in North Korea, did you feel welcome by the people of North Korea?
Mm-hmm. As a Swiss, I must say I had the advantage that Switzerland has next year it's 40 years of diplomatic relations with North Korea. We, as Switzerland, we form diplomatic relations with all countries. So North Korea is no exception. And therefore, when they learned I was Swiss, I was warmly welcomed. They had a hard time to place me because I was living in Hong Kong, I was working for an international agency, so they never knew where, under which department I was to be under. Was it the European department, or was it the international department, or was it the one that was dealing with religion? But overall, foreigners who work in North Korea for international agencies and the UN or NGOs, they are welcome. And it's sometimes almost embarrassing that, you know, they do their utmost to make our life comfortable. And you know, your neighbors are struggling. It's Asian hospitality, and that is also there.
I was quite surprised by that beautiful, what you said, it was a Protestant church?
Yeah.
Would you comment a little bit on the religious situation there? Are there the Protestants and Catholics thriving? What's going on?
Well, the government claims to have religious freedom. There are three churches in Pyongyang, two Protestant and one Catholic Church. It is, however, like the whole country, a very controlled church or churches. Personally, I believe that among the people that go to church on a Sunday, there are some true Christians. And I say this because I observed reactions during special visits. And then there are others who simply go there every Sunday. In the Catholic Church, it's of course even more complex because of the structure. There is not even a priest. So on a Sunday, there is a prayer service to which we foreigners are also invited to go. And the same on the Protestant side. Also, South Koreans that visit usually go to, there are very often church groups, so they usually also go to church on a Sunday. So for me, it was also an opportunity to meet people who I, other visitors who I otherwise would not meet. A few times during my time there, we had priests visiting with humanitarian aid groups, and then they were usually allowed to read Mass at Changchun Church or also read Mass for the foreigners. But it's a very, very difficult situation.
What is the dominant religion there?
None. So, and of course, there was, Christianity was there. On the Catholic side, we had Marinal missions there, and we had the Benedictines from Germany there, and also Protestant missionaries, the Presbyterians, and many others were there, but it's all, you only find traces nowadays, but you still do find some traces.
How did you become personally involved and engaged in working with North Korea? Where did your interest stem from?
Well, it's basically all coincidence, I must admit. And being a curious person, I like pioneering work, and I had that opportunity with China. I moved to Hong Kong for Caritas in summer 78. To work in Hong Kong, and initially I worked mostly with the Vietnamese refugees in Hong Kong, and we also had a scholarship program in Hong Kong. And then end of 78, Deng Xiaoping announced the opening up of China. So as Caritas, we started in the early 80s working into China. And I did that work up to about 1995, when North Korea basically landed on my desk. I had met a North Korean at a UN meeting in Beijing. I was there. It was a meeting for the preparation of the Year of the Family. I think it was 1994, so this meeting was in 1993. When I met the first North Korean, and I simply thought, how interesting, never met a North Korean. And that's really how it all started. We stayed in touch. He invited me in already in 1994. I was in Beijing at the North Korean embassy wanting to collect my visa, and I was told I couldn't go because it was just the day Kim Jong-il had passed away. So I had to return to Hong Kong, and then I visited for the first time in April 1995. And we had already then, and I had said I cannot just visit as a tourist, you know, is there work Caritas could do? And I was given 4 proposals, which I then followed up. And then in summer, they had disastrous floods. And that's when they asked the UN to come and assess the damages, and they also asked the Swiss government to come and see with their own eyes. And I was asked to join that delegation, and that's how then the ball started rolling, and all of a sudden I was doing more work in North Korea than in China, and eventually I even moved to North Korea. And it's been a unique and wonderful experience, which I would not want to miss, despite many ups and downs and difficulties. but also a lot of joy and interesting days.
Is there a restriction on like how many people can be in a family? And the cripples. I don't remember the question. I'll just keep it with that one.
Okay, it's all right. Family size is two or three kids, not because government imposes family planning. Simply, women don't get pregnant because of their nutrition, or they do not want to have more children. Interesting is also that, for example, among my staff, very often they had a teenager, which was a girl or boy born before the famine, and then after 10 or more years, when the situation improved a bit, they had a second child. So there is a big gap between kids in many families. But average is one or two.
Hi.
Hi.
In the picture that you showed us, people look like really ordinary people, because I thought they are having a difficulty of poverty. So which class people in Pyongyang, which class of people who live in Pyongyang, and do you think, do they satisfy with their life? And have you ever met people who are against North Korean government or just complain with their government?
Okay. A whole basket of questions. Now, among these people you saw, there are also ordinary farmers. But, you know, Koreans are very proud people. So whenever we came, they would dress up the children. Nobody told them to do so, but they would dress up the children as good as they could. Women would wear a little bit of lipstick. So appearance is very important. It's also keeping face. So very rarely would we really see, you know, people in rags. And you don't see very many, but there are a few. And poverty is not in the streets. Poverty is hidden behind homes, houses, walls. So it's not that you see it obviously. You need a trained eye, but then you see how people suffer. Or in summer, for example, you see much, much better how skinny the children are when they swim in the rivers. In winter, when they are wrapped with clothing, you know, you don't, and they have quite high cheekbones, they don't look like starving children you may be used to from other countries. But the reality is a different one. Pyongyang people, of course, are better off. Most of them, even in Pyongyang, there are some poorer areas, because Pyongyang is the window to the world. That's where most foreigners get to. That's where, you know, they want to preserve a certain image. It would be risky for people to complain about their government. And I also think, as long as people struggle just to survive, they don't even have time to complain. The issue is, do we have enough food? Is everybody okay in terms of health? So complaining is not that high on the agenda, and particularly not vis-a-vis foreigners, because that would also be a risk. The only time I felt some dissatisfaction among the people in Pyongyang was during the time when they had a very failed currency devaluation in winter 2009. But otherwise, people just try to make a living, try to survive and move forward. And as I said, I felt now there is even a bit of optimism that they have more freedom to find their own coping mechanisms.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it. I have a couple of questions. First, were you able to get any Korean homes? And if you were, what that was like? And two others related to hunger and malnutrition and stunting and so forth. During Soviet times, under Stalin, mm-hmm. There was the practice of extracting surplus food and other goods from the rural population to transfer it to the urban population in order to pacify them. Was that practiced at all? That's a great deal of starvation and malnutrition in rural areas. Was that practiced at all in North Korea?
Okay.
And the third question was you didn't say much about military spending mm-hmm. and how that impacted, I mean, the trade-offs between guns and butter, basically, and how that impacted on availability of butter.
Balancing food supplies, yes, that was done. Before the famine, it was very clear-cut. The provinces, the granary of around Pyongyang and towards the south, had to deliver food to the northern provinces because there very little is grown. But that all faltered with less food produced and also hardly any means to transport food because the diesel has to be imported too. And that's why a lot of assistance from the international community has gone to the East Coast because that's where the biggest needs were and still are. And I think only when enough food in the granary is produced again, then maybe some will be shifted up there again.
I meant Pyongyang in particular, so yeah. They wouldn't riot. I mean, pacify the population. Was that practiced at all?
Maybe
just to repeat myself. Under Stalin in particular,
right.
During Soviet times, there was a practice of extracting surplus foods from the rural population to the centers in order to pacify the population so they weren't hungry and riot, basically. Mm. I mean, when you're highly condensed, it's easy to organize and create trouble, basically. When you're highly dispersed in rural areas, you can't do that quite as easily. And so was that practiced at all into Pyongyang in order to pacify the urban population there, as opposed to the north of North Korea? I wasn't referring to that.
Well, I mean, already now, this public distribution system is still in place. So cooperative farms have clear targets which they need to fulfill. Mm-hmm. And that food then goes into the government system mm-hmm. and is allocated to the cities. And of course,
at the expense of the rural population, those who grow it?
Sorry?
At the expense of the rural population?
A cooperative farm, each farmer can keep a certain, in practice, mm-hmm. it's about 200 kilos of grain back for his own consumption, and the rest has to go into the public distribution mm-hmm. system. Of course, if they grow less, then everything goes down. And what happened in 1995 was that the floods also destroyed the stocks, and that's why they had to reach out for international assistance. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done that. And the stock is, of course, to feed the urban population. Mm-hmm. But I have never seen any food riots or anything.
Okay.
It's still, a very controlled mm-hmm. system.
And then the military spending.
The military spending. Of course, as I said, the government could do more, could do better, but I don't think they will as long as they feel threatened. And the other big problem is it's a huge military, over 1 million people. And how can they reduce the military if there are no jobs? What would they do with these people who are no longer serving the military? But the military also has to build roads. They have to go and help with planting rice in spring with the harvest. they have to do a lot of civilian work. And then, of course, there is the elite troop to which nobody has access, and that's where the money is spent on, you know, the nuclear issues and all that. But I just think they will not trade it away until they don't feel more secure. And then your first question was Korean homes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've been to many Korean homes because as food aid monitoring activity, you enter Korean homes. And it was very interesting because in those apartment blocks you saw, occasionally we would divide in groups because, you know, six people entering a small apartment is not really what you like to do. So we would say we go to three apartments, which we would be allowed to, and in the evening we would compare notes. And then we had the feeling we all had been to the same apartment because they were absolutely, totally uniform. And why? The whole building belonged to a certain work unit, and this work unit had been providing the... They have very little furniture, some Korean cabinets, chests, maybe a television, then a low table, the same pictures, the same refrigerator, the same sewing machine, because it was all part of the salary or benefits from their work unit. So that was something, it took me a long time to figure it out.
That's an official capacity. What about like the North Koreans on your staff into their homes?
Not as
an official Swiss representative, yeah. But as
no, we
as
foreigners
a colleague
are not or... allowed to visit Koreans at home.
Okay.
And it's also, I must say, it's also not necessarily in their custom and tradition. It's the same in Hong Kong. I don't know how many years I was in Hong Kong until finally one Chinese New Year I was invited home to one of my Chinese friends. And also in South Korea, I think I've only been twice to a South Korean home, and I've been to South Korea many, many times. It's also a different concept. You invite people to restaurants.
Thanks.
Thank you for being here. Do you find our press, the papers that we read, generally accurate, generally fair in its reporting? And what would you consider our greatest misconceptions about North Korea?
It's a very, very good question. I worked, of course, also with the press for many years. And I can tell you, sensations are easy to place in the press, but if you want to say something ordinary, something perhaps even positive, they don't even listen to you. So we have a lot of, or we only have negative press about North Korea, and what I find so sad is that with that we forget the 24 million ordinary people who just want to make a living. So I think we need to be careful when we read the press and try to see the other side too. It is very, very one-sided. Of course, I'm not denying the problems with the nuclear issue, the problems with human rights abuses, but still, it's not everybody. And I think if we can help the ordinary 24 million who struggle for survive, we may then bring about change.
My second question is, what do you see as our most most common misconception about North Korea and the people?
Well, quite often I'm told North Korea is a concentration camp, full stop. You know, that the whole country is a concentration camp, and I think that is simply not true. But it's very hard to bring that message across that there are people who just want to live, who don't even want to leave the country because that's their own country and they have very strong feelings for their own country. I always compare it with a circle. And people, ordinary people, have learned in a very pragmatic way to live within that circle and make somehow a living. And the problem really starts when they, for whatever reason, step out of the circle. But those inside the circle, they also need our attention, and they don't get the attention they need.
In the meantime, maybe I'll ask a question. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, Mennonite colleges in the United States went to China, and China was just becoming open to receiving Westerners. And Mennonite colleges set up a program called the China Educational Exchange Program, where each year Mennonite professors from Mennonite colleges in the U.S. and Canada went to China to teach in a university in China, and Chinese scholars came from China to study and teach in Mennonite universities and colleges here in the U.S. You said people-to-people exchange you thought would be very important with North Korea. I'm thinking maybe it's not yet possible to do this in North Korea. I would love to hear your opinion about that. Or are there any other universities in other countries that are doing this kind of thing? And is this something we ought to try to promote from our university base here in the U.S.?
I wish it could happen, let me say that from the onset. It's probably still very difficult because of the relationship the U.S. has with North Korea, and also no diplomatic relations. I would think there might be a chance if you could do it with MCC Canada, which is politically a bit easier, or in another country. Because we have realized that quite often it works better if we do a program, not necessarily in North Korea, in a third country. So that's one way to perhaps go about, and also it's important to identify the areas the North Koreans are really interested in learning, because certain things, you know, for them it's not priority, and then they would never get the permission to attend training programs. And it takes a long time to build something up, so I think the sooner you start talking to the North Koreans, the better. And then you also have to talk to your own government, because North Koreans need visas to come to the US, and quite often they are denied the visas to come. And then you disappoint them, because when they have gotten all the procedure on their side ready, and then you have to say, sorry, now our government is not willing. Finding the balance is sometimes quite difficult.
First of all, thank you so much for your sacrifice and service for North Korea and also the world peace. And this is my fourth year in Harrisonburg. I met some wonderful folks who consider Korea, and especially North Korea. And I met R. Martin, and he and some other local people has been trying to support North Korea with a housing project. Even it's not easy, because we don't have a timely response from the North Korean counterparts. And one thing I have a question for you is, what made you have a desire for North Korea? And I know North Korea is not easy country, and even it's not easy country for you to live in 5 years. And I want to know what made you drive for North Korea, whether some kind of mission or some desire or some kind of vision.
A bit of everything. A bit of everything. I mean, I like the people. I think you can work with North Korean people. You can also work with the North Korean government. It's a challenge, but it's also, it has given me a great satisfaction. And personally, I also feel it's a country where you can still do something and see results, which you cannot do in many other countries anymore. So I hope I will stay involved even after Stanford, because I do also hope that one day there will be a solution to the divided Korean Peninsula. I personally find it shameful that after 60 years, we still don't have a peace agreement on the Korean Peninsula. And I really think we need to work towards a peace agreement. The peace agreement is the end result, but there is a long, long path to get there. And I think that's where we hopefully can work on.
Well, thank you very much, Kathy. And thank you for all being here. You've given us a lot of time and a lot of information. And I think we've all enjoyed it and we've learned a lot. So thank you all for coming out this evening. It's been, a very good evening.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too, and reconnecting with the Mennonites has been a special pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Most welcome.